Ryan, Berkowitz, Elton, and James, so we have a quorum. And the first issue up is, last time we were here, we passed out CS for HB 464, which has to do with the veterans, and we had an amendment to the title. And when I called we called the drafter, she didn't quite like the wording of our title, and so.
I told you, Berkowitz.
So anyway, and I said, well, you know what we mean. Tell us how we should say it. And so before, you should all have a copy of the title change. And before I transmitted the bill, I just wanted to see if there was any objection to the title change.
Looks great to me, Madam Chair.
I think Representative Hodgins might still be maintaining his objection. I'm not sure.
No, I will not object.
Okay, so we will transmit the bill.
This is finally the way I want it.
Okay, all right. So without objection, we will transmit the bill with that draft of title change. Okay, we have no people wanting to testify, but we have the Anchorage and Fairbanks LIOs online. And the next piece of legislation is, oh, there you are. Okay. Senate Bill 309, an act relating to the use of force by peace officers and correctional officers by Senator Ward, and we have staff here to present the bill. Go ahead,
Thank
sir.
You. And if I might, I have the show and tell, if I might just show you these so that
okay.
you know at least what we're talking about.
Okay.
Not real close, I hope.
Here.
What's inside the little rubber, the bullet right there?
Well, these are rubber bullets.
Yeah.
Oh, these
and then there's a bean bag round, so they kind of go together. That's there. That's
okay.
one that's
right.
ready, and then
Everybody,
the projector.
I can just pass these.
Yep.
You can take a look at them.
For the record, my name is Craig Johnson, staff to Senator Ward. This is a very simple bill. What it does, basically, technology has somewhat caught up with our legislation or some of our laws. The way the law reads right now, that any projectile fired from a weapon capable of firing a lethal projectile is considered a lethal weapon. What this bill does is remove these incapacitating rounds that the police officers use in situations that are not intended to permanently injure or kill someone. It takes them off the list of non-lethal weapons. In your packet, there is an article where a bullet stops a suicide. This happened after we filed this bill. It's not, we didn't plan it, but it probably couldn't have happened any better. This was a situation where a woman was holding herself hostage, as it were, with a knife, threatening to commit suicide. The police department determined that the best way to stop this attempt was to use a beanbag round like Mr. Representative Berkowitz has in his hands now. It prevented an officer from having to go in and disarm this individual. It protected her life. It protected his life. This bill was generated in terms of history. This bill was generated as a request of the Anchorage Police Department. Their SWAT team, and I also need to at this time let you know that Senator Ward's son-in-law is a member of the SWAT team, and so that's the genesis of this legislation. They don't feel like they are protected. That if they use one of these rounds while trained, under orders, specific orders from their supervisors, with proper training, there's still the opportunity that they could face liability based upon using a lethal weapon or a lethal firearm in a non-lethal situation. That's a little bit on the history. It's a very simple bill, and I'd be prepared to answer any questions at this time.
Ryan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On the surface, you know, it doesn't appear to have any problems, but what if one of these guys uses one of these things, he's a little close, and he causes a grievous bodily harm or death? You can be killed if you're close enough from the wad on a blank round. And, I'm concerned a little bit about taking liability away from police officers and especially prison guards. I unfortunately don't have a have the highest respect in the world for prison types and many instances of abusive behavior and so forth on their part. I'm just concerned someone's going to get really hurt and the people are going to walk free saying, well, we didn't really mean anything. But you're going to have somebody dead. How do we make sure that these guys are responsible for their actions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, the bill clearly states that operating within the guidelines and by a fully trained officer, if they are out of those guidelines, which would include that distance, the guidelines that they operate under, firing too close, this would not protect them from that if they were not operating under orders within the guidelines set forth by the department. It would not cover someone who blatantly did it. It would not cover an officer who has not been properly trained or is not operating within those guidelines. So this is to cover the rare accident when something might happen. So it very clearly states within those guidelines, and if they're operating outside of those guidelines. The other thing that I think that we should be aware of is, you know, this does not indemnify someone from being sued. You can sue anyone for any reason, and if the merits of the case hold up and the individual is found to have been negligent or not operating within those guidelines, we haven't indemnified that individual from this. What we've done is maybe taken away an opportunity for that lawsuit because we're removing that use of deadly force definition to these rounds. That's what we've done. We've maybe taken away a nail in the carpentry bag of the attorney to sue, but we haven't removed it. There's still that opportunity, and if an officer acts negligent, they should be held responsible for their actions. It's not the intention of this bill, and I don't believe it does that.
Is it Ryan?
A little follow-up, Madam Chairman, is just that if I inadvertently kill somebody, it's manslaughter. If a public employee inadvertently kills anybody, it's a civil lawsuit, and that bothers me, that these people are not tried under the same criminal statutes that I or any other citizen would be because they were in the performance of their duties and it was an error of judgment. So you still have someone that's maimed or dead. Someone's life has been affected dramatically by someone who works for the state. And perhaps that's my liberal side coming up as a civil libertarian. But I don't trust these guys. I don't trust them any farther than I can throw them. All the cops in the world and all the prison guards, if you don't watch them, boy, they're going to do some of the worst things that's ever been done. Anyway, that's why I have some.
Well, Representative Ryan, if I could just respond from my position on that issue, speaking only for myself, is that we have a world of people who make mistakes. We have a world of people who have the wrong attitude and are not trustworthy. I'm not willing to take the position that no one's trustworthy. I like to believe everyone's trustworthy, and then when I find they're not, then I'll know that. But I can't live in fear of every single person. Representative Elton, you're next.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't see a distinction here between correctional officers that are employed by the state or correctional officers employed by a private firm. So I'm assuming there isn't one, and maybe you can nod yes or no. The other question is, I mean, what is the definition of a peace officer? I mean, is that a whack and hut security employee? Is that?
Madam Chair, no, sir, it's not. There is a statutory definition of peace officer. There's also a statutory definition of correctional officer. One of the amendments proposed in a previous committee was that we say guards throughout the legislation. The Department of Corrections came and testified on behalf of this bill in support of it. They asked to have guards changed to correctional officers. We found that correctional officer has no status in statute where guard did. It would have required quite a substantial rewrite to make that what appears to be a simple change. The answer to your question, I'm not sure that we have private correctional officers. It's very new to the state, and I don't know that we've defined that yet. I think the operative term in this is properly trained. And if it is a correctional officer that has been through the training, the SWAT team training, that has been trained to use this, I think they would fall under this legislation. I qualify that by saying I think. We've not really, once again, it's a very new, private correctional officers is very new to this state. But the proper training and under orders, I think, covers that area.
And can I follow up? I mean, proper training, would that be defined by the court?
We define by the, I think it's the police standards. there's a police standards that they would have to meet. As it stands right now, there are only about a half a dozen or so police officers in Anchorage. I think Anchorage is the only one that use this right now at this time that are trained to do this, and that's the CERT team and the SWAT team, the very highly trained team that's mobilized in hostage situations and you know, the black shirted guys you see in the movies. So they're very highly trained. They go through regular psychological testing, and I think that's the type of training that would have to be met prior to anyone being allowed to use that and be covered by this legislation. Now, if someone used it, this would not be in effect. If a police officer who hasn't been trained, then they're up to the same rules of engagement as any police officer would be. If they violate those rules, they're liable. The training element is key in this.
Representative Berkowitz and then Hodgins.
I just want to say I've worked with a number of police officers and correctional officers, and I would venture to say in response to Representative Ryan that their degree of trustworthiness is higher than in this body. So
Representative Berkowitz, I don't think that's a proper statement to be making. People could take offense at that, and I don't think that's the right way to comment. So go ahead.
To my way of thinking, this bill is very simple. It just defines non-lethal firearms. And these ballistics that you're showing here clearly are not designed for lethal purposes. But like anything, they can be used in a lethal fashion. And there's no exemption under this statute when these are used in a lethal fashion. And there's no immunization part of this. It seems that, to me, this is a straightforward definitional bill.
Put on the record that Representative Ivan is here. Representative Hodgins, you have.
Yes, I would agree with Representative Berkowitz on the non-lethal firearm definition. However, the second part is defensive weapon. Defensive weapon, I don't know if a 357 is defensive weapon. And I'd like to maybe find out about stun guns, pepper sprays, and, you know, there's a bunch of different weapons that might be used that would fit under defensive weapon. And I wonder why
357 is a defensive weapon.
And I was wondering why you didn't have a definition in there of defensive weapon.
It was not the intent, necessarily the intent. This designed primarily for the prison guards who may be in a riot situation. It's kind of a two-part question. First of all, to address the pepper spray and the 357 and the other types of weapon. The way the statute reads right now is any projectile fired from a weapon capable of firing a lethal projectile is considered a lethal projectile, even though they were designed not to do so. I'm not certain that there is a projectile designed for a 357 that's designed not to be lethal. The statutes are covered, the pepper spray and the other types of net guns and other things are fired out of a special weapon. It's not a multi-purpose 12-gauge shotgun that fires both, you know, anything from birdshot to slugs to these non-lethal projectiles. So what this bill is designed to address is that very narrow definition of what a lethal projectile is. And so if you fire in a defensive mode, fire 357, that's not what this is designed to do. This is specifically designed to fire these weapons that are designed to be non-lethal in non-lethal, in lethal. May I?
Representative Berkowitz and then Ryan.
I agree with Representative Hodgins, which is why I wish he'd speak up more often. It seems to me that the concerns that Mr. Johnson's raised are addressed in the non-lethal definition. I mean, what you're talking about with this definition is the projectile, and that defines what type of firearm you're using. Defensive weapon it has no meaning. It's vague. And I think the intent of this bill is covered simply by using the non-lethal firearm definition.
Do you have a response to that? Okay, Reverend Ryan.
Well, I have a question about the physical properties of these things. I'm not sure how much knowledge you may have. If this is fired from a 12-gauge shotgun, it will open up as it meets the resistance of the air. And for a period of time, coming in this direction, friction the area being exposed to the air will slow it down appreciably, and the force is spread over an area. If it tumbles, and it happened to hit like this, with this small area, even this little bit of weight concentrated on this area like this, you get lots of thousands of pounds per square inch or so forth. What is the range on these things before a shot that hits like this delivers X amount of force, and one like this that could concentrate that force and cause some serious harm and or shock or penetration? Or has anybody done any work on that?
Mr. Chairman, you represent Ryan. I'm certainly have. I'm not a physics expert. I do know the design of the bag is such that when it hits on a corner, the lead shot expands, and if you were to take that square, that sharp edge, and push it against your hand, you'd see that it would spread out. So it's designed to distribute the weight evenly, less so if it hits flat. That's where that proper training and under direction comes in. They have guidelines. And I would be remiss in to say that people haven't been injured by this. I mean, this is not... When a police officer has to make a decision to fire one of these type of projectiles, it is a situation very much like the suicide situation. Someone is going to have to go in there and disarm this individual. Someone is going to be endangered. It's a riot situation. These are not situations where people are playing. These are dangerous situations, but not the level of taking your revolver out and firing it, but a level below. The police kind of view this as a long baton, and certainly if you hit someone in the head with a baton, you may do real serious damage. But when the person who is properly trained and needs to subdue a suspect or someone who's resistant, and they use it properly, it's a very effective tool. This is a long baton. This is a far-reaching baton that keeps the police officers out of harm's way, and that's the way they view this, as simply a method of subduing. In this case of the... the newspaper article where they subdued the woman, her arm was broken, but she's alive. There's a police officer that's not injured now. So the decision was made to use this weapon, and so it's a very unique situation when it's used, but it's better than pulling out your 38 or whatever you might be carrying and that determination. The way the law reads right now, the officer that fired this weapon at this lady was the equivalent of pulling out his 38 and shooting her in the arm. That would be totally frowned upon. He would be in massive amount of trouble, but by statute, that's the same because he fired a lethal projectile, these rounds. So it is the belief of the sponsor that a person acting under training, under the rules of engagement of the department, should not be held accountable as if he pulled his 38 revolver out and winged someone like in the Western days or something. So this is very clearly designed. And once again, the statute is only for projectiles fired from weapons capable of firing a lethal projectile is legal. So it's a fairly narrow definition of what this does. It doesn't take in the new technologies of the nets and the foams and the pepper spray, but those are not designed to be fired from weapons capable of firing lethal projectiles. Long answer to a short question.
I guess that one of the feelings I have on this bill is that I think that it has gone through other committees and come out this way. I'm a little uncomfortable with the defensive weapon, but you say that it's the load that makes the determination, not the physicalness of the weapon. This does have a judiciary referral, which I feel real comfortable with Brian Porter on that and his police experience. So I guess that, you know, without anyone giving me any real ways that we need to amend this bill, I would be comfortable sending it on to judiciary where it will get another review. Representative Berkowitz?
Let me give you a way to amend it.
Okay.
I would just remove paren 1, paren, comma, or 2, defensive weapon. So the sentence would read, the force that the guard or peace officer may use includes the use of a non-lethal firearm, period.
The motion before us is to amend on line 8 by taking out the the paren, one paren, and then take out or number two paren, defensive reference, so it would read that may include, includes the use of a non-lethal firearm. Is there any discussion you want to talk about your amendment?
Also in line 9, you'd have to eliminate non-lethal firearm or a defensive weapon needs to be eliminated, too.
Okay, let's see. Or it would have to come out as well. Okay, well, you want to speak for your amendment?
I like what Representative Hodgins had to say about the subject.
Okay, is there any objection to that amendment, Representative Hodgins?
I don't have an objection. I just want to know if we had somebody that was going to testify on.
Don't have anybody on LIO. Is there anyone here in the room that wanted to testify on the show?
Anybody from public safety?
Don't see anyone. Everybody, Ryan?
I'd like to ask the sponsor's aide what his feelings of what the sponsor might think of that. You think he'd be comfortable with that?
My guess is that anytime you change anyone's bill, there's a certain level of uncomfortableness. This bill was drafted with the assistance of the Anchorage Police Officer Association. Their attorneys played an important role. It was sent out. It is based upon a bill that was drafted out of Iowa that basically they had the same problem. This bill has been thought out by people who know more about this than I and probably more than the sponsor does. It was done at the request of the police department with a lot of input. Until I would be able to communicate with the sponsor and those people and attorneys that had that input, I would certainly have to think that although I don't see a substantial change, that the sponsor might want to have that opportunity to review that amendment. And if it's something that makes sense, would certainly not object to it. Once again, this was brought to our attention by the Anchorage Police Department as a loophole where technology has kind of surpassed the law. I don't know that it answers your question, but.
Well, let me say what my position is on this issue. I understand the concern. It seems to me like defensive weapon is broad. I guess that I don't expect people to bring something to this committee without it being amended or having the possibility of an amendment. And so I feel a little uncomfortable that you're not able to respond to this. However, if we were to pass this amendment, and it does go to judiciary, I would say and suggest that if this is not a good amendment and you have a good argument that it shouldn't be changed, that you have a right to bring that up when you're presenting the bill to judiciary and exactly tell what happened. And you'll have two people that are here today that will be there and can confirm that that's exactly what happened. So if this was the last committee referral, I would like to put it off and go check with the sponsor. But since it's not, I'd rather not.
And yes, ma'am, and I appreciate that. And if I, to paraphrase Representative Ryan, he asked about a comfort level.
I understand that's what he did.
And I express that comfort.
You can't tell about another person's comfort
yes,
level.
But
you
I
can
certainly,
guess about it, but you can't.
Yes, ma'am, and I certainly appreciate your abilities to amend bills. And
okay, all right.
Doing anything that
Thank would. You. Representative Hodgins.
Yes, I would like to know a little bit more about the mechanics of a bill. If we change it in this committee and then it is changed back to its present form in the next committee because of a compelling argument, does that mean that is then a CS and it has to go back through the Senate side?
No. What happens, two things could happen. We could amend it here. It could go to judiciary and they take the original bill, not the amended one.
Okay.
They cannot take our CS. They can take the one that if
okay.
the one that we passed out.
I'd have no objection.
And
to that.
Or if they wanted to, they could do a CS again. And any time there's a change on one side or the other, it does then have to go back for concurrence. But, you know, I think the process of scrutinizing legislation is not one that I disagree with. I think I've watched some legislation come out and have the problems with it after it's already gone through the whole process and signed by the governor and didn't have close enough scrutiny to have errors in it that caused something we never intended to cause just by the way the language was drafted. So I think intense scrutiny of the legislation certainly is warranted. So anyway, the motion on the floor is to, on line 8, reduce, take the one out and take the or defensive weapon out, and also on line 9, take out or defensive weapon. Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, then the amendment is passed. Is there any other discussion on this piece of legislation, Representative Berkowitz?
I'd move SB 309 as amended with attached zero fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, the bill is the motion before us is to move the bill from as amended with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note. Is there any objection? Hearing none, and the bill is moved. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have up is SCR 22. We have staff for Senator Miller. Before we begin, I want to apologize for not having heard this before. We didn't have a request or a sponsor statement or anything, and we're waiting for somebody to ask us to do this. So go ahead and tell us about this resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Gore, and I work for the Senate President, primary sponsor of this legislation. There is no sponsor statement, primarily because Senator Miller felt that it was self-explanatory and he didn't want to waste the paper. So basically, the resolution supports Kids Voting Alaska program, which began in Fairbanks in 1992. Kids Voting is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization funded by businesses, primarily Alyeska, NBA, and CARS. It's operated by hundreds of volunteers across the state. The goal is to teach Alaska youth about the fundamental democratic principles of voting and promote good lifelong voting habits. The curriculum will be taught in at least 35 school districts during the school year, and during the next general election, about 90% of kids eligible around the state, 120,000, will have the opportunity to vote in the general election. I've heard about the program here in the Juneau School District through a staff person in Senator Duncan's office who worked the polls actually here in Juneau the last time around. And her kids started talking about it at the dinner table, and they were all excited and talking to their parents about different issues that were going to be on the ballot and different things that different people that were up for election, and started encouraging the parents that, you know, we need to vote, Mom. We need to vote. We have to go to the poll on the day that they're going to have the election. So, unfortunately, I can't say if we had a larger turnout at the polls here in Juneau. Maybe Representative Elton knows that, but what I do know is one family felt it was a really unqualified success just based on the discussion that it led to at their own dinner table. So that's basically a summary of the bill, and Senator Miller encourages your support.
Representative Hodgins?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one question. I think it's a good idea, but if this is self-explanatory and there is no reason for a sponsor statement, why is there a CS?
Because they added in the committee on the Senate side, they added two more people that they wanted the resolution sent to, actually.
Uh-huh. Hey, Ryan?
I couldn't get in the way of this. I remember when the program started in Fairbanks, I lived there. Just as an aside, I tracked the kids voting candidates, their votes, versus the general election, and there was a wide disparity between how the kids voted from what they heard in school and how the general population voted. Very wide disparity, and it favored people not particularly of my party, the kids.
With some exceptions, I would note.
Yeah, when, you know, in that respect, there is that concern, and it's especially in the conservative ranks, there is the concern, I have it, for the education that we're giving our children not being balanced in many cases. I think certainly balanced education is very, very important, that we shouldn't be on one side or the other of the issue. My experience with the North Pole School is that the teachers there have done a very good job of making it balanced, and so and I guess that's quite frankly because I always come out ahead. I think that a pretty good message from the kids, but
that's
just to make a little suspicious statement. But there is that concern, and I don't know what the oversight is on the teachers and their influence on the children. But my observation, at least in my school, is it's very balanced. But I do know that the kids come home from school having learned something in school that certainly is far afield from where my position is on issues. Do you have any response to that?
Other than the program itself, the curriculum is designed to be nonpartisan.
I understand that, yeah. Representative Berkowitz.
I would just observe that perhaps it's the students are voting the right way because they're studying the issues.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. And certainly they are studying the issues. Without a doubt, they're studying the issues. So, and it's tough for adults sometimes to come down on the right side of an issue. It's a very tough job. Representative Ivan.
I'm ready to move this.
Do it.
I haven't moved a controversial bill in my... I moved yes for Senate Concurrent Resolution 22, State Affairs, with zero fiscal note, individual recommendation.
Okay, the motion to Horace is to move SCR 22 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note. Is there any objection? Hearing none, then the bill is moved. Thank you. Next up, we have House Bill 44, and we have staff for Representative Bryce.
Madam Chair, Representative Bryce would like to present the bill itself, so I'm going to call him really quickly.
Okay. Tell him to hot foot it. We have a caucus at 9.
I'll go grab a cup of coffee and I'll be right back.
Pardon? We're at ease. 44. Do you think we need to call this person? Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to the committee for hearing House Bill 44. The idea of 44 came to me during some discussions I was having with some folks who were trying to gain admission to the Pioneers Home. They were concerned that, given the constant state of rate increases, that they were going to become, or the rates were going to grow so fast that they were going to be unable to afford them. Say they apply to or get on the waiting list in January on their fixed income, they could afford it. Say in a year when they finally gain admittance, that amount of income would not be sufficient to cover the cost associated with getting in. They brought that to my attention, say, gee whiz, it would be great if we could at least have it in statute that that once we get into line, that we're locked in at that rate. Well, locking in at that rate causes some major constitutional issues about equal protection and equal access, those types of things. But what you can do is ensure that they would not be disqualified from entering based upon their ability to pay. And that's what simply House Bill 44 is. The department had made some suggestions on page 10, or on page 1, line 10, where it's sentence goes, an applicant who is otherwise qualified for admission to the home may not be disqualified for admission based on failure to make an initial payment. They said instead of possibly based on failure to make an initial payment, based on some type of statement of financially unable to make the initial payment. Failure basically means that, well, I'm just not paying you. I might be financially able to, but I'm just not.
What is it they're looking for?
I think that maybe it would be better, instead of failure to make an initial payment, inability to make an initial payment would be better.
That would be fine.
Reverend Ryan.
Isn't this the way the Pioneer's Home were originally set up? That the old people, when they reach a certain age, they had a place to go.
They got a place to go. The as we all know, the original purpose of the Pioneers Home was for the old miners who had, you know, done their time out on the creek beds and had no place to go. They'd have a place to, you know, spend their last days. I'm not quite sure it's necessarily there anymore, but I do know that in the term of, or in the scheme of things, that it's very important that the state provide or work with the community in providing long-term care, and Pioneers Home is part of that. And I think what we would do here is definitely add a certain amount of comfort in those making application that they know that they would not be denied access to the Pioneers Home based upon ability.
You know, I guess my comment on, and originally the Pioneer Home was for pioneers, and pioneers, you know, are have to be here, what, 25
mm-hmm.
years or something like that. And originally it was intended for those people who were here at statehood who had been contributing the same longevity bonus. It was part of that same program. And, of course, the lawsuits that we've had over the permanent fund dividend, our income tax program that we had in 1980, I believe it was, and now the Pioneers Home is that you can't require them to be pioneers, that it has to be open to anyone that's lived in the state for a year. So now it just happens to be a state-paid nursing facility. And so what's been happening over the last few years, because it is such an expensive operation, is that what's been happening, we've been raising greatly raising the amounts of money that the people have to pay to stay there. They're still not, even at the rates that they're charging the people, still not paying what it costs to be there. So all of the people that are there are not paying their costs, but those who can are paying a much higher fee. And there's been a lot of distress from the pioneers on that issue because, you know, even though they have the money to pay, they have other things they like to do with their money besides pay for their board and room. And so when it started going higher and higher and higher, they began to worry that they wouldn't be able to stay there anymore. So we did pass legislation a couple of years ago that said if you're in there and your rates go so high you can't pay anymore, that you should that you can't be kicked out.
That's right.
Because everyone is nervous then. If this keeps going up and I only have this amount of money, then, and these are older people that you don't want to be nervous about the rest of their life, I mean, absolutely, they need to have as much solace as possible in their later years. So we passed that piece of legislation so they can't get kicked out. Quite frankly, when I evaluate the legalness of that with equal protection, if we have people who are in there who don't have to pay, it appears to me that if there's people that qualify to be in there, we owe them the same benefit. And if we don't do that, it seems to me like there might be an opportunity to challenge that. But the other thing I wanted to make and put on the record is that the Pioneer Homes are an extremely expensive way to provide a home for these people, and that there are other, you know, assisted living homes and caregivers out there, and we're trying to get more of them so that people can live more of a normal life instead of an institutional life, which the Pioneer Homes is a great place to be. I've been there. It's really a nice place, but it still is less than you can get if you're living in someone's home and have close attention. So, and that's much less expensive and more efficient. So, you know, we don't have enough places. That's why there's a waiting list, and I think this is a good way to go on this issue, but it doesn't cover the whole concern that we have. And it's a big one, and I've been very frustrated with this whole issue for the 6 years I've been here as to how to manage the growing cost of the Pioneer Homes. So, and not necessarily because it doesn't provide a good home for some people, but that is it so extremely costly more than other systems. Representative Hodgins, you had a question or a comment.
Yes, I had an observation I'd like to ask the sponsor, and then I'd like to make a motion to move it. In the fiscal note, it says zero fiscal notes, but if we're actually going to allow people not to pay, it would seem like there would be some sort of fiscal note generated.
Through the chair, Representative Hodgins, it's current policy. It's not statute, but it is policy. change with the whims of the wind, that someone will not be denied admittance. So they are currently doing this. My concern is that under the constant pressures that Madam Chair has brought out, that that policy will change. And that sometime in the future, it could be reasonably assumed that the administration of the Pioneers Home would definitely base one's acceptance upon ability to pay.
Thank you.
And before we move the bill, you have this one amendment that we were going to do on the word failure, change it to inability. So if somebody would like to make that motion on line 10. Okay, Representative Ryan moves that on line 10, that we replace the word failure with the word inability. Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, then that is amended. Now, does anybody want to make a motion to move the bill?
Madam Chairman,
yes,
I would make the motion that we move House Bill number 44, amended, out of State Affairs to the next committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, the motion is to move the bill with a zero fiscal note from committee with individual recommendations. Is there any objection? Hearing none, then the bill is moved.
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Representative.
Now that we're done with all of this, I do have a comment on the,
yes,
on the committee. And it must be apparent that the VZ caucus will not be joining us anymore. I don't see packets for him. And I was wondering if that's if we're down one member or...
Representative Hodgins, for the information of the committee, I have requested from the leadership to have a replacement. They have asked me for a list of five names of who I'd like, and I said anybody that'll come. But I did make I think four people that I could think of that might have time to do it, because everyone is so severely tied up with other things. So I'm just waiting for a replacement.
Madam Chairman, I would take on the double duties if the voting was appropriate.
I don't think that's allowed, Representative Hodgins, so I don't think I can...
I can supply you with more names.
And they have to have certain qualifications to be able to be filling that slot. It is a majority position.
It is a majority position,
and we have been without a majority member there all year. So,
unfortunately, that doesn't leave all the best qualified candidates.
Oh, okay. There's one more thing before we adjourn. On Saturday, we'll be hearing SB 105, the ethics bill. And that's the only thing we have on the agenda. And we're supposed to have a majority caucus on Saturday, and I don't know what time it is, whatever time it is. But if we could get that out of here on Saturday, it is. And we needed to go a little past 12. Is there anyone that could not do that?
I'm sure I will not be here on Saturday.
You won't be here. 1, 2, 3, 4. That means we have to agree on everything. Well, we might not be able to get it out then.
Madam Chair, that gives too much power to Representative Elton.
Right. Madam Chair, that's not a frightening thought to me.
I get a proxy from the minority member.
Unless we get another majority member between now and Saturday. We might not be able to move it. I would like to get through all of the amendments. And so you're not going to be here, Representative Berkowitz, after all this trouble that you put into this bill?
Well, I didn't realize you were going to schedule it. You know how much I love this bill.
Well, I thought I made that perfectly clear. Well, in any event, we will be hearing it on Saturday, and we're being pressured, as well as my wanting to get it out of here, to get this bill moving. So... we need to spend as much time on Saturday as we can. Is there anything for the rest of you to hear this, go through it, and at least get to the point where we might be ready to move it? Do you have any problem staying a little later?
Depends on how sunny it is outside.
Oh, okay, just me.